It's 8:12. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, it's been 7 years or so since the last strategic plan was done in the Park City School District. It sounds like we're about to embark on an effort to revamp it. In the studio with an update following yesterday's school board meeting, I have Park City School Board members Andrew Kaplan and Petra Butler. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
So Dr. Rohr from the University of Utah explained the difference yesterday between master planning, learning plans, and strategic plans. One of you want to give us the Reader's Digest version of these?
Sure. So the strategic plan is kind of the overall framework for what we do as a district. And best practice is really to review that every 5 to 7 years. The last time we did it was 2009-10, so it's been a little bit overdue. Really everything should kind of come from that project. You know, when we made the decision, which was a difficult decision a couple weeks ago, to postpone the bond, the main catalyst for that was the realization through our own work as board members, through, you know, with our constituencies, as well as a survey done by Y2 Analytics and our communications firm, Wilkinson Ferrari, that the community, while they understood the need for facilities, they didn't really buy into what we were trying to accomplish as a district. And they wanted the ideas to be better vetted and better communicated. And really, it's not all that different from what's typical after a bond failure, where you have a bond, it fails, and there's a kind of a post-mortem and recovery time where it takes a couple of years to really, educate the community as to what the true needs are, get consensus, get buy-in, and move forward. And as a district, we realize we need to do that. And part of that is to do the strategic planning process again and really get a feel for the community as to, you know, what we want our schools to look like, what we want our graduates to look like, kind of the overarching themes and vision for our schools.
So, Petra, there was some hesitation, I think, from you. I mean, whether or not that this process will be effective and getting that done?
Exactly. You know what? I think there's, at least on my part, there was some confusion about how all these plans work together. And I think I needed to get a better understanding of what the strategic plan really focuses on. And it focuses on the mission, the vision, the values, and the goals for our school district and for our community as a whole. It's kind of the umbrella process, if you will, that everything else will flow from. And so I didn't have a really good understanding, but I had a much better understanding after our discussion yesterday during the board meeting.
So the superintendent discussed during the strategic plan process first, then master planning next year, early March, then holding a bond election maybe in 2019. I mean, do you both agree with that timeline?
Well, I think we're, you know, we discussed it openly in the meeting, and I think there's a lot of different ways that we can approach this in terms of timeline. And, you know, what I spoke about in the meeting and one of my concerns is that we have, you know, as we know, immediate facility needs and we have growth in our district. And, you know, we don't know the final numbers for growth this year, but they're going to be mid-single digits. And that's large. You know, the last few years we've had kind of low single digits. We're probably looking at, you know, mid-single digits this year, and we'll, you know, we won't know till a week after the school starts. But, you know, when we have a district of roughly 5,000 kids, and if it grows 4 or 5% a year, you know, we're going to run out of space really, really quickly. You know, we already have trailers at a number of schools, and we have facility needs, and there's other projects that we want to work on. So, you know, it's we have to marry the community's interest of taking our time and using a thorough approach to spending what is going to amount to a tremendous amount of taxpayer dollars for capital needs with addressing our immediate needs for facilities. And so that's going to help determine our timeline. And I think that's what we're going to discuss in the coming weeks. And Petra, you know, suggested to have a special regular session purely to discuss the timing and the framework for all of these projects.
Well, in the past, Andrew, you've mentioned kind of your frustration with wasting time and that we need to move forward because mm-hmm. we have these needs. I mean, so is the strategic planning process in your mind a waste of time, or do we need to go through with this?
No, not at all. I think it's a very valuable exercise, and it's something that can help, you know, frame what we want our schools and our district to look like for the next 7 to 10 years, and that's something that we desperately need. But I think it, you know, my first take, my gut instinct would be that we do that alongside moving forward with other things. So alongside with, you know, master planning, alongside with understanding what our immediate needs are. And, you know, one of the things that I think we have to look at as a district is, you know, there's some complicated things such as what do we want our grade realignment to look like? What do we want our high schools to look like? But then there's other things that, you know, if we realize that we have 5% growth or whatever, 3% growth or whatever it is every year, and it's young families that are coming to our community, well, it's probably pretty obvious then that we may need to do something to increase our elementary capacity. You know, so what we want to do is I think continue to have this being a living, breathing thing and be looking at the long-term planning, but also be looking at our short-term needs.
Yeah. So, Pedro, I mean, do you agree with the timeline? Or, I mean, I'm kind of hearing Andrew saying that we need to push that timeline up and a bond not waiting until 2019. What's your take?
Well, you know, I think it's really important that we look at what our enrollment is going to be. I mean, if we do, Leslie, have a 4 or 5% growth this year, I don't think that's what was expected. And I think that really is a prioritizing of our facility needs. I mean, what are we going to do with all these extra children, especially if we have another growth like that next year? So I think we need to look at that. We need to prioritize. And we may need to run these processes simultaneously rather than waiting for one to finish before the other starts.
Yeah. So is the board united on the issues of the district? And, I mean, does the board have a priority list of what needs to happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think the board is united. We, you know, we're all on board with the immediate facility needs. We're having an offsite shortly, and we're going to go over our board priorities. And you know, but the things that we've invested heavily in, we continue to. So, you know, mental health, and you know, one of our priorities this year is going to be safety for our students. And you know, while we've been dealt a small setback with our facilities, we are moving forward with a number of our initiatives, and we're having some successes, and we're continuing to attract very good talent from around Utah and around the country to fill, you know, positions as they become open. And you know, we have a new principal starting at Trailside who's excellent, who's coming from the Valley. We have Dr. Ben Belknap coming, who's our new associate superintendent of wellness, and some really, you know, high quality individuals who are pushing forward, you know, what the board and the administration's priorities are in earnest. And we're excited about that. I think, you know, the challenge for the board is always to be able to continue to push forward and improve on what's already a great district, but make it even better. And we all recognize that we have deficiencies and we have big projects to work on. But I would say we're all relatively confident that we're going to move forward and that we're going to get the facilities right. And in the meantime, because those take a long time, we're gonna work on our initiatives that we can have success with on a quicker time frame.
Yeah, you, Andrew, had mentioned that you're concerned that if we don't make some decisions soon to address the facility problems, the district will be in terrible shape. How so?
Well, I mean, you know, I think we just both addressed it. It's, you know, we have capacity issues. We have trailers at most of our schools, and we have, you know, another 200 kids coming in this year. And, you know, the issue is that we end up not being able to have the small classes that our community wants. We end up not being able to have, you know, we'll end up with very crowded buildings. We'll end up with, you know, less choices.
Yeah. The only solution, though, I hear you telling me, though, is that we need to build our way out of this. So I haven't heard anything talk about split days, year-round schools, things like that. So, I mean, it seems like you've got one goal, and that's to build more.
No, not necessarily. I think part of this whole strategic planning process, this master planning process, I think all of these will take what you just suggested into account. We need to look at all options. And, you know, Leslie, we even need to look at our programming. We need to make sure that we have all the appropriate programs in place. If we don't have programs that are really benefiting our children, do those programs really need to remain in our schools? I think these are all issues that we need to address.
So where are we with the listening tour? Last I heard is that we were going to go out and do a listening tour, but I haven't seen any dates or any schedule for this. Is that still happening?
Yeah, it's still happening. You know, I think the board members will be at back-to-school nights, and that's kind of our unofficial kickoff of that. You know, we'll be at all schools, and we'll be scheduling in the coming weeks some, you know, some community forums and our ability to listen. You know, we're also, you know, working with several groups in the community to reach out and try to, you know, host these forums in a formal basis. And you'll be hearing more from us in the coming weeks on that.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the district has hired Wilkinson Ferrari to help market the bond initiative to the community. So what's happening with those efforts at this point?
You know, we'll be discussing that at our next board meeting. I think this past board meeting was to specifically focus on moving forward with the strategic planning. And the strategic and planning will include them. And that's going to be discussed on our September 5th meeting.
Okay. So we are moving forward with doing a strategic plan. We're going to use the University of Utah to do that.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
That's correct.
And you had also heard from Dr. Rohr that this is not a model that's used actually in an academic setting, that it's actually used for businesses. Do you have an issue?
It's used in both. I think what I was asking was what's the kind of the academic success rate, or because what she mentioned was this is a process that's comes from the private sector, and I think we all know that the private sector is very different than a public school system. And so my question was more, what is the success rate, and, giving us some examples of districts that have employed this. And her point is that it's something that has a lot of the empirical evidence and the academic research has been done on the private side rather than on the public side and in the school districts. But, this is her profession and her expertise, and there's certainly, evidence to support this is a valuable exercise.
So with the hiring of a full-time communications director with a background in bond and bond
Correct.
Campaigns, do we still need the assistance of Wilkinson Ferrari, or are we kind of...
Yeah, absolutely. If you look at... our new communications director, she had expertise in Jordan School District, which quite famously had a $500 million bond. So if you think ours is big, that was a lot bigger, and that was shot down, by their community. And it took about 2 or 3 years to recover and get a bond pass that they needed. So not too dissimilar from our situation. And she was very integral in that process. And then Wilkinson Ferrari, they're a communications relations expert on bond issues, and they've been used on all of the city's campaigns. They have a good knowledge and success rate with our community, and we're going to continue to use them as a consultant at least through the end of the year. We have them contracted through November, and then we'll look at potentially renewing them for a bond in 18.
Yeah, so this is really kind of a sticky situation, isn't it, that we're using tax dollars to hire this firm to come up with, because the board wants a bond passed, right? But at the same time, is it, can we do that? Can we use tax dollars to hire a firm to see how it is that we get a bond approved?
Well, it's certainly, they're a communications relations expert firm, right? So their job is to help educate the community when we're going to bond. And should we decide not to go to bond in 2018, no, we wouldn't, we wouldn't have them as a paid consultant next year. But should we decide that we are going to go to bond, that's common practice for school districts and municipalities to employ those types of consultants and specialists. So it's, I understand what you're saying, but it's, it is a priority for our community and for our district. It's not just the school board. It's, people know that we need new facilities. The issue is, and even, people in CBED and, traditional kind of no voters, they all agree that we need new facilities. It's just, how do we get there? And I don't think that anyone is going to make the argument that that we're fine, we're not growing, and that we don't need buildings. And so, yes, if we decide not to bond in 18 and we want to go to a 19 schedule, should we spend that money in 2018? No. But if we decide to bond in 2018, I don't see an issue with it.
Let's move on to the high school graduation update. Some mm-hmm. encouraging news there, showing some accomplishments in closing the achievement gap, which has been a huge issue. Principal Bob O'Connor and his team presenting the work done to improve the ESL and Hispanic participation in the AP classes. Also, graduation rates hitting 97%. That appears to be the highest since 2011. So what does the school board need to do to help reach that goal of 90% college and career-ready students?
I think we need to continue with exactly what we're doing. I think we're providing our district with the resources that each of the schools need in order to make that happen. One of the things that we've identified is we just recently had an expert come in and talk about interventions for our students, especially for those that are lacking in that area of achievement, specifically in the reading area, because we need to know, we know that we need to have children reading ready at the third grade in order them for them to be successful all the way through high school. So that's one of the things that we need to focus on. So I think when we talk about Bob made the comment about, you know, we need to focus on those kids not only in elementary school, but we need to know where they are when they get to the middle school and when they get to the junior high all the way through high school. And I think we need to focus on those students to make sure that they those are the kids that we want college and career ready.
Yeah. So do we have a date, a goal date for making this happen?
Well, that's what we're going to focus on this year. We've had lots of teacher training over the RTI process, the intervention process, about how we're going to focus on that. That's a big plan that we're putting together this year, so that we'll have that done by the end of the year, so we can really start to focus on these students.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when Bob did the presentation, I believe it was 2021 graduation that he looked at, and, you know, those students are currently in Ecker. And so the example he gave was that, okay, it's not enough for him and his team just to focus on the kids in his building. And likewise, it's not enough for the board or the administration to focus on just the kids in the high school building in terms of graduation rates. If our target is 4 or 5 years out, then we need to be looking at the kids in Ecker today and saying, okay, which of these kids need help to close that gap in order to become, you know, college and career ready? And that's the project that we're looking at as a district. And, you know, if you look at our goals as a district, if you look at the superintendent's goals, there's a lot of goals that are 3 to 5 years out with regards to test scores, with regards to proficiency, with regards to college and career readiness. And in order to do that, we have to focus on the kids, you know, from the earliest ages, you know, pre-K through, you know, elementary, middle, junior high and high school. And that's kind of a new perspective for our district. And it's something that we have the right leadership in place to look at that, and we have the buy-in from the board to support that and to fund it. And, you know, we're looking to help all of our kids.
And I just want to jump in real quick, too. We talked about adding additional classes to our four-year-old program next year, and that ties into this entire process. We need to start as early as possible with getting those kids educated and school ready.
All right. I also want to ask you about the decisions recently to add two more people to the district office, of course, with our student wellness associate superintendent and now the new director of communications. We're talking about expensive positions here, $100,000 plus with benefits and stuff. Just a couple of years ago, and this is, again, before your term, but, I mean, we worked hard to reduce the size of the district office, and now we're just back to where we were, if not bigger than ever. Do you have any concerns with that?
I don't. I think that we're increasing the administration in line with the increases in our student body. And so if we were increasing our administration at a dramatic rate that was not in line with our student needs, I would have a concern about it. But we're, you know, as a district and as a community, we're going through transitions and we're becoming larger. The needs are higher. We recognize that the role of public education is ever changing, and it's important for us to support our students. And so, you know, having a director of wellness and someone who's at the associate superintendent level to oversee that, we have real needs, and we need that administrative support to help our teachers teach and to help our kids learn. And so I think we'd be doing a disservice to our students to not give our teachers that support.
Yeah. Can we afford it, though?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, one of them was simply a change. It was a slight increase in with regard to the director of communications. But if our hashtag is safe and healthy, you know, both of these positions are going to tie into that.
Okay. Anything else you guys wanted to mention?
Just today, 4 o'clock, come meet our new principal over at Trailside. Join us, please.
Okay. And that, again, the name?
Carolyn Sinan.
Okay. Guys, thanks.
Thank you, Leslie.
The Park City Council meets in work session tomorrow starting at 2:45 and will consider the impact of its plastic bag ban, as well as the future of chain stores on Main Street. In the studio, I have City Manager Diane Foster, along with Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before we get to the agenda items, Diane, when do the microtransit proposals come back to council for a vote?
They're coming back on the 31st of August. There's a team who's already looking at those and evaluating those, and we'll see what happens.
Okay. Can you tell us what's going on in front of the TMI there? Over Art Fest weekend, we had just water rushing out of the garage. I think you've gotten dug in with the sidewalks and kind of found that you've got some old pipes.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. You know, there's been water coming out of there periodically all winter, and the initial tests show that there wasn't chlorine in the water, which typically means that it's not culinary water. However, I was talking the other day with the distribution manager, Kyle MacArthur, and they're continuing to do some more work on that. We do, you know, old pipes in this town are difficult, and not only are old pipes a challenge for any water system, but we also have soils that actually eat pipes. So in a lot of places, particularly in things like Prospector, where we know we have some tailings that are now covered, but we have tailings under there, when we dig down into that, they'll actually throw in a bag of magnesium, and it's called cathodic protection. And what it does is the nasty stuff will eat the bag of magnesium before it eats the pipe. So we do a lot of work to try to manage the pipes, but they are doing more investigative work on that now.
Okay. What's the latest with the China Bridge Garage? We had heard at the PCA meeting that we're on track for the December 15th new demand-based parking system, but we saw some setbacks there, some issues that we need to deal with, just again, an aging structure?
What's good is the structure's in good shape. What we have is an incredibly dirty structure. So in talking with the parking manager Kenzie Colson last evening, she mentioned that it took 2.5 days more to clean it than expected. And the reason was, she said, it was really, really dirty. So we don't have any structural issues or anything like that going on with the parking garage. And she's, as are all of us, we're really excited because visually that place will look different. It will look brighter. It'll have better, you know, we forget as locals that, you know, it's a small garage. But if you're from somewhere else and you go up to the second floor and then you go over to the Egyptian, you might actually forget what level you parked on. So we're going to have more things that you see in places, other places where you have colors and numbers and things like that.
Okay, let's move on to the agenda. We'll be discussing in work session at 3 o'clock the proposed amendments to the noise ordinance. I'm guessing this is your topic here, Bruce. When we talk about noise, we're talking about constitutional issues. It's my 10th Amendment rights of health, self, safety, and welfare against your First Amendment rights of free speech?
That's it in a nutshell, Leslie. But more importantly, what we're trying to do is make more clarity in the code so that we can enforce it better. I went to the Planning Commission a couple of weeks ago. The Planning Commission gave us some suggestions and found that it was very, very technical. I think that had to do with the way that we presented it to the Planning Commission and gave them all the background data on how you measure noise and how noise is defined. So the outcome of all of this is that we have a much more enforceable noise ordinance. We'll be doing some proactive enforcement, and you'll see a collaborative effort between the police department, code enforcement, and the planning department to actually walk the streets and measure noise levels and just make a determination how the noise is affecting the neighborhoods. And that includes Prospector and Park Meadows. There's an interesting map that code enforcement has and police department has showing where the noise complaints happen most, and you'll find that it happens closest to the high school, not necessarily Main Street. So either that or we got some really crabby neighbors in Park Meadows out by me. So that's what's happening with that, and we just need to give council an update and let them know what we're doing.
So we can't just set a decibel level and enforce it?
Well, the answer is roughly no, because there's a whole bunch of definitions of noise behind that that need to be codified. So we can tell the general public what that is. All those background definitions are where all the real work is going.
So, and we do have a standard. So in the code right now, the level is 65 decibels, and the proposed ordinance is the same decibels. But as Bruce said, it's not just that. It's also how far are you from it, and in some cases, time of day matters.
Right.
All right. So those are the changes that we're changing, the time of days and how far away?
Times of day are not changing. Decibel levels are changing slightly, recognizing that they're logarithmic and they change more than 1, 2, 3. But mainly it's the back of the house information, how we measure and making sure that our noise meters are calibrated and that we enforce consistently between planning department, building department, and the police department. I think that's the biggest issue for the neighbors is they'll make one call and we'll come out and nothing really happens or nothing appears to happen. And then they'll make another call and police will come out and then they'll enforce. And we just got to clean all that process up and let the public know how to handle this.
Okay.
And so we do have time differences and day differences and commercial versus residential. So we think this is, Bruce and I, as well as the whole team who've been working on this, think this is a great step. And we're also, we're in the process of purchasing a couple of new noise meters that are highly calibrated.
Sustainability Project Manager Celia Peterson will have an update on the plastic bag ban. What kind of feedback are you guys getting now?
It's interesting. I know on KPCW it reported that the store manager said that we hadn't talked to him. It turns out the person that Melissa spoke with was a department manager and not the store manager, because our staff have been in contact with the store managers. They have talked about some problems that they've experienced, they have received complaints. We haven't received any at the city. We do have an email address if you'd like to email us, bagban@parkcity.org. And I think one of the pieces is there's always kind of a learning curve and a little bit of pain in any implementation process. The reality is bag bans exist all across the U.S. and in many, many resort towns. We're not reinventing the wheel here.
So when do we implement it for the rest of town?
It's implemented citywide in Park City. It's limited to certain bag types, so the super thin bags. It's also limited to stores of a certain size.
Right, but we're not going to require Main Street.
We will consider it, but right now we need to see what the implications of this this regulation are. I mean, it's not a good idea to go regulate heavily without having an idea of what the consequences are. And so we're kind of monitoring this on a day-to-day basis with the sustainability department and with the public, and we're watching it. We are not in favor of a rapid response regulation.
So taxpayers are buying signs for stores to be posted outside reminding people in Spanish and English to bring their bags into the store with them. Anything else that taxpayers need to absorb from this decision?
I think when you look at the taxpayer expense, the signs are really cost effective. They're super inexpensive. And this is a community value that the council has responded to. So the community wanted this, and the city has implemented it. We do want to provide support to the stores both. There's a program going on right now. So Celia Peterson, who works with Luke Carton and Sustainability, she's running point on this. So there's a group right now. It looks like there's a need for reusable bags. And so there's a group in town who's a community group who's interested in supporting that, and she can support them as well.
All right. And we will soon have one dog-free trail. Just one, huh?
You got to start somewhere. Yeah, this is pretty exciting. You know, the city council, there was a lot of discussion when Round Valley became a 1,700-acre off-leash dog park. And I in particular was really worried about it. And I run out in Round Valley, and I've been so impressed at the trail manners, the dog manners, and how attentive people are to this. Now, that being said, there are still people who have had bad experiences with dogs, and some of those are afraid of dogs. So this was City Council wanting to respond to that, and this trail will go from basically the Creekside Park over Boot Hill and over to, it's kind of behind Dan's Fresh Market Snow Creek area.
Okay, and we still have a few easements to work out before we can officially allow people on this, or people have been walking on it for years. Yeah?
It does, but as you mentioned, city staff does want to perfect the easements before we make it official and put up signs. But staff believes that we're pretty close on that one.
All right. Real quick, the city will be accepting $1.5 million from Salt Lake County for Bonanza Flat. How much are we still floating on this, $38 million?
I believe we've hit our goal now.
In terms of collecting all of the money that people promised?
In terms of collecting all the money, no. In fact, things like the Summit County, right, that the $2 million grant is going to come in over 4 years. So the city will float some of that, but we've bonded for it, so we're not cash short.
So those bonds have been sold?
Bonds were sold in the May timeframe.
Yeah. What does Salt Lake County get for that $1.5 million?
Salt Lake County gets watershed protection. It is one of their top priorities, and they don't have the You know, a lot of our water, about 30% right now. Historically, it's been around 50%, but the Judge Tunnel isn't online right now. So with 30% of our water coming out of mine tunnels, we have a very sophisticated treatment process. Salt Lake doesn't have that. They do chlorinate their water, but they don't have a lot of treatment, so they have to really work on source.
So on the agenda, we see after this acceptance of $1.5 million, there's a water supply agreement with Salt Lake County. Is it just coincidence or do they?
That is coincidence.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just one. It's an extension of a Spirit Tunnel agreement on water.
All right. And the council, Bruce, will consider the chain store amendments to the land management code. So we are defining chain stores as having 10 stores or more?
That's correct. And just to be clear, Leslie, it doesn't matter at the back end who the actual owner of the store is. It matters at the front end how they're signing it. The uniforms, the products they're carrying are what control the definition, not necessarily who owns the business or the building.
So are real estate offices considered chain stores?
If they meet the criteria of what our chain definition is, then yes, real estate offices are covered under the conventional chain business ordinance.
Okay. And is Jan's Mountain Outfitters a chain store? Because they've got to have 10 stores or so.
But remember that we're regulating according to the name. So something like White Pine is a Jan's store, and they're not the same name as Jan's. The two or three stores that the Jan's company owns over in Colorado are different name brands. So that's why we regulate as names, not necessarily as the back-end owner. And we've had a couple conversations with the ownership at Jan's on this and made clear how we're going to regulate. So, for example, the Marmot store acts like a Marmot store. It doesn't really matter who owns that business organization in the background. They have a similar product, a similar brand message, and a similar set of signage.
So Jan's is not a chain store.
That's correct.
All right.
One of the things on that, too, just so the public knows, yesterday we re-noticed the packet and republished it with a modification to the business license. Where we have a pending ordinance now, basically it's like the chain ordinance is already in effect. So until the city council decides yes or no on this, you can't have a rush of chain stores that would come in and kind of grandfather themselves, because existing chain stores on Main Street are grandfathered. So one of the things we noticed was in our business licensing, we wanted to clarify some language, because what we saw was some people trying to come in and try to get vested with a business license, because there is an exception there that even if you don't have a building, there's an exception that the building official can grant that. It's not something we want to be doing, and we really want to be clear with the public about where we are on this. So we're bringing that to City Council on Thursday as well. So that is in the reposted packet.
Okay, and that's where I was. I know it was brought up at the HPCA in terms of they couldn't apply for tenant. They couldn't apply for a license until tenant improvements were complete, but that wouldn't make a lot of sense. I mean, why would anybody make tenant improvements unless they knew that they could go into the building?
Well, the reverse is actually true, Leslie. The idea is that we issue a business license after we have an inspection for health, safety, and welfare of the site. It doesn't make sense to issue a license if we haven't inspected it. And so in this particular case, you have to do the improvements and you have to have a building in place before we can go and inspect it and make sure it's okay for human occupancy. And that's the reason we do it this way. So, I understand there's a risk to the business owner. We've had long, long conversations about that risk, but it's not any different than any other tenant improvement risk on any other building. The conventional chain business is kind of irrelevant to this question.
And then in terms of how many we allow, we're at the 15%. Is that what we've decided?
The staff brought forward a recommendation of a total of 28 chain store, conventional chain businesses between the historic commercial business and historic recreation commercial, which is the Marriott area. Planning Commission reduced that to 21 between those two areas, which is approximately 15%.
And that means that we can add 13 more chain stores to Lower Main and just one in Upper Main, or is it the opposite?
To be clear, at the 15% level, there's room for one more south of Heber Avenue, and there's room for six more north of Heber Avenue in the storefronts. So this is combined with the 50-foot storefront regulation and also with the regulation prohibiting offices and real estate offices on Main Street. So if you're within 8 vertical feet of the street, you're under the storefront enhancement program, which is where pedestrians are. If you're above that, say north of the pedestrian bridge, past Collies towards Mustang, then you're not regulated by this ordinance.
Okay.
And to go back to a high level, right, this is, you know, when you get down to the regulation level, sometimes people tune out. This is really about preserving community character. And, you know, one of the benefits of city tours, we go to other resort towns. And walking through Aspen last year with council member Cindy Matsumoto, it was just stunning to see chain store after chain store. It kind of felt like you were in the mall in Salt Lake or something. And so this is really about preserving the character of our Main Street. And that's something that's important to our city council.
Okay. Diane, Bruce, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Friends of Ski Mountain Mining History have a couple of fundraisers coming up. And good news is that one of them has sold out. In the studio, I have members Sally Elliott and Rory Murphy. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So coming up August 24th, people had an opportunity. I know you put a lot of invites out to people to explore the Old Spiro Tunnel?
The Ivers Tunnel. Yeah, go ahead, Rory.
Well, the Ivers Tunnel is connected to the Spiro about, I'd say, 300-400 meters in. But, yeah, we're able to go into a mine tunnel. It's a functioning mine tunnel. The city actually maintains it. Water comes out of that tunnel. So it's a unique opportunity, and we were very fortunate to get Lloyd Pop and one of the old miners to make sure nobody gets too far in there or does anything they oughtn't do, but people get to go in and have their picture taken. So it's kind of a neat opportunity.
Yeah, so flashlights and hard hats, and it's cold back there.
It's very cold. I hate those mines. I don't know why. I spend more time in those things. No, they're just, you know, they are what they are. They're dirty, cold, wet, but they are neat. They're pretty exciting. So.
And really, it doesn't happen every day that you get to go back into one of those. So this is a $500 per person event. That's impressive that you sold out.
It's very impressive. And the committee that Rory heads up was working very hard on it for months and months and months. We had lots of lovely donations. Alan Long has built Sunrise Realty right there at the Ivers Tunnel and has brilliantly incorporated the natural history of the place with his new office park and has done an amazing job of preservation. But, of course, he had a great teacher in Rory who did the whole Silver Star project and won historical awards for it. So it's all good. We have some people who are passionate about preserving our mining history.
And it's Alan's company, just to be accurate, is Rising Star Realty.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. And Alan was the chair. He did the heavy lifting, okay. And then Don Roll, who's on your Broadcasters Club, was always also a, you know, he did more heavy lifting, and then Hilton Early picked up whatever was left. And
Don Simons has been helpful, too.
A couple crumbs I lifted, so I would hardly say that it was...
Well, it's quite the team.
Well, coming up then, September 13th, still an opportunity to support the cause.
Absolutely.
What's happening then?
This fundraiser is called Celebrating Our Roots. Marianne Cohn came up with the idea of having scrumptious food at Legacy Lodge, and the chefs at Vail Park City Mountain have just absolutely put the big pot in the little one. We're having an Irish boxty potato cake with smoked trout and creme fraiche, English leg of lamb with red currant thyme compote, Napoleon of fried polenta and Italian grilled vegetables, souvlaki with tzatziki, gazpacho, potstickers, cheese enchiladas, and desserts. It just sounds like a scrumptious menu. It makes me hungry to think about it. But this is a time, September 13th, when we'll all go to Legacy Lodge at 6, and we'll have music. Small House Strings, Marty Morrison and Drew Frank are going to provide the music as a donation to us. You know, everybody wants this project to succeed, and everybody's kind of pitching in to help out with it. We're very fortunate.
So what are you going to do with all the money that you've raised this summer?
Blow it right away.
Well, we one of the things about this nonprofit is that there is no overhead. There's no employees. It all goes to We have a couple contractors. Lance Kincaid and Clark Martinez are hard at work. They have been for a couple summers now. Renovating, stabilizing is probably a better term, the old mine sites up that, you know, we all love and we all know they're there. We go up and we explore them in the summer. We ski by them in the winter. And it's just cool. It's like it's the icon of Park City. It makes us different than everywhere else. It gives us a unique history, a unique place or unique reason for people to come see us. But they, you know, they're not going to last forever without a little bit of love. And that's, you know, Sally really has been, you know, the quarterback here, just trying to get down the football field and get these things. And, you know, really it's a matter of raising some funds and getting the right guys working on them.
So how much do you have in the bank?
Well, I'm not real sure. We have the California Comstock is almost finished. Clark Martinez has to get up there and do just a little bit more heavy lifting. There's a building that's fallen down, and it's come off the building. So we have to put that back. We have to do some masonry work. The King Con counterweight up on First Time Run is almost finished. And then maybe this winter, while we don't have much else to do, we can get the boxes of rocks built to sling under there, because it was heavy rocks that actually held the cable taut with this counterweight that went from the city bus barn up to where the King Con mine was on the middle of Claim Jumper. So we have a lot of work to do in the wintertime. But in addition to the actual construction work, we have to have completed construction drawing plans, and they have to be approved by the city, and the city is most particular. So I'm hoping that late in this summer we can have Jonathan Richards go up and give us actual construction drawings for the Little Bell Mine at Deer Valley, for the raising of the Daily West. We need some recommendations. We're hoping next summer to actually complete the stabilization of the Jupiter ore bin, the Little Bell ore bin at Deer Valley, and the King Con ore bin at Park City. So that'll be probably upwards of $150,000. We have amazing partners at Deer Valley, amazing partners at Park City and Park City Mountain, and we're all working together. But this project is probably going to be north of $1 million by the time we finally end it up.
It's probably a 10-year project too. But Vail has been absolutely terrific as a partner and extremely supportive. Everything we've done, I got to give credit where it's due. They've been really good to us and really been trying to help. But the one thing also next summer we're hoping to do is raise that Daily West mine shaft again. So that's kind of a iconish project.
Okay, and that's there at the base of the Empire Lodge montage.
Montage,
that's right.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But we should note, I mean, Vail Resorts, I mean, they're required to do this as part of their development agreement, yeah.
And I can't recall exactly what the verbiage was. I mean, I was involved in that agreement 15 years ago, but there was a certain, I think, monetary value that was required to fix up the historic buildings. And so Vail did have an obligation, but the fact was they've met that obligation and they continue to donate money, resources, time, effort, and so, you know, they are going above and beyond.
In all fairness, Blaise Kerrig, the minute he came on board, was in sync with all this and excited about it. And when Bell Rock came on, we attacked him with equal vigor, and he was right on board because it's cool, as Rory said. It's just one of the wonderful things about skiing in Park City. So, you know, they were on board before they had to be on board.
Okay, people are interested in joining you on September 13th. What can they do?
There'll be a link on the Park City History website. Just click that link and give them your credit card number. Call me at 640-3759. Email me if we can get you tickets if you're interested. Thank you so much.
What is the cost, Sally?
$100
the cost
is $100 per person,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Sally?
And every nickel of that will go to the project because it's a donation from Vail.
Okay, Sally, Rory, thanks.